Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. This is the second part of episode 70, which was all about White Dwarf covers and included Thunder Phase. Don't see this as a supplement. It's more like one of those things that you look at and think, shouldn't this have been included in the core rules? Yes, I'm afraid that this podcast is more of a Kill Bill 2 than Godfather 2. It has very little to add other than continuing indulgent chat. In the second part of the previous podcast, we did our Thunder Phase response, answering listener questions. They've been submitted via our social media channels and Discord over the past few months. Me and our resident rules lawyer, Judge Blythe, entered the Zoom of role-playing rambling and went through them at a medium fire rate. We went on and on for more than we anticipated, so rather than condemning this to the desktop trash, I thought I'd put it out there. We didn't even get through half of the questions that were posed, so we'll keep hold of them for another episode later in the year. Also in this podcast, there's a brief postbag to relay how the Grog Squad have responded to the White Dwarf covers nostalgia. We'll also be giving a shout out to all the patrons that have come on board over the past couple of months. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Thunder Phase!
Okay, this one's from Anonymous. Anon?
Okay. Anon.
He's got how do you organise your library of RPGs? Do you have a room of one's own? So you're in the converted garage. That isn't your space, though, is it?
Officially, no. Unofficially, yeah. I've gradually taken over. No one else really comes in here.
I feel very privileged that I've got a room. But it's a bone of contention in our house. It's why should I have a room of my own?
This is the thing, you see. They're after your room. They come for your room, that's the end of it.
Virginia Woolf, isn't it, room of one's own? I nearly said Virginia Andrews, but she's a different proposition altogether.
It's a different kind of writer altogether.
And I'll take a one's own. So how do you organise them then? How are they sorted out? Because I have the veneer of being, having some level of organisation and order, but I haven't. Mine is totally chaotic. They're broadly grouped into shapes that I'm aware of the sort of games that are in a particular area of the room compared with the other area. To give a sense of this is that I know that down here on this shelf down here are ones that I've played or ones that I've got out of interest but may not necessarily play. The ones over here to my right that it needs to hand are the ones that I've got on the go at the moment. And over on that side are the more prestige collections, the ones where I've got multiple numbers of, you know, like the Conan. I went crazy over lockdown. They're all together. But I say they're all together. Not all of them fit on, so some are on other shelves and they might be on the... Really, it's chaotic. I haven't got it in any kind of order whatsoever.
Well, I'm similar, actually, but mine is like a kind of football league table in shelf format.
Right.
So what happens with mine is there's two bookcases, right? Two big bookcases. And at the top of those bookcases, top and middle, eye level, and just below, what I've discovered is, and this probably is by design, unconscious design, but not deliberate. When I look at it, the games I play the most are on those shelves. They've clustered together. So the games I play the most are there. So Traveller is there. Vason's there, Old School Essentials is there, Savage Worlds is there. And I look at it and I think, these are the games I play a lot. I run them a lot and I play them a lot and they're there. And there are new arrivals, so DCC recently got into that, really like it. That's kind of in that position. And what's interesting is, as DCC's moved in, something else has moved out. So something else has dropped down the shelf.
The relegation.
It's dropped down the league table, the shelf league table, because I realised, oh, I don't really play that much at all, or I've gone off that a bit. So I tell you what, I'll move that and put it a bit lower. And DCC's going in because I like that and I'm playing that a lot. And this other thing, whatever it might be, has moved down. And of course...
So what you're saying is, come on, let's name it. Numenera is now in the Champions League. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Vauxhall Conference. Yeah, it is. It is. No, you're right, because this is what I'm coming on to. So imagine DCC arrives. Oh, I like this. This is great. That's going in there on the second shelf, right? Getting in there. Something else is moving down. But of course, for something else to move, something else has got to move, hasn't it? Things shuffle, it all shuffles along, doesn't it? So not only does something get relegated from the top end to the middle, something gets relegated from the middle to the bottom end.
Right.
It's got to, hasn't it? Because there's no room. There's no room. There's no room on the shelf. The shelf, there's no gap waiting for new arrivals. Something's got to move. Something's got to move. So when I look at my shelfie, that's the word, isn't it? A shelfie. It's really ordered by what's popular. And the things at the bottom, right at the bottom of the second bookcase, are the things when I look at them, I think, I don't play.
I think that's sort of what's going on with mine, but mine's a bit more like the butterfly effect, you know, that somebody farts in Japan and it causes my
somebody buys a new colon supplement and ED fifth edition bursts into flames. That's what you mean. Yeah. Well, that's how mine's organized. Not alphabetical or anything like that. It's literally by a kind of weird process of I'm looking at these shelves and my eyes are drawn, or the things that are prominent are the things I play the most.
But it's fraught with difficulty, isn't it? Alphabetical does not work for games.
No.
Because?
No. Just because it starts with an A doesn't mean you want it there right at the beginning.
Well, not only that, blind it. Take Dungeons and Dragons. Do you put that under D?
Well, yeah, put that under D.
What about Advanced Dungeons and Dragons?
Oh, of course. Yeah, do you put it under A? Yeah. And basic under B. Yeah.
So RuneQuest, right? Got RuneQuest, that seems straightforward, doesn't it?
Mm.
But does that mean that you have your RuneQuest stuff at the different side of your shelves and Glorantha stuff? Or do you cluster all your Glorantha stuff
your
Quest World stuff?
I agree. It is. It's fraught with problems, isn't it? Yeah.
So do you put it together by setting? Is that how you do it?
Or by system?
Or by system, yeah.
D20 percentile, yeah. Well, I think you do. I'm intriguing, isn't it? It's intriguing, but mine is strangely organic, like I say, governed by what I'm playing and what I'm interested in. Yeah. You could carve my shelf up into thirds and go, right, this third, these are the things he really loves and he plays a lot. The middle ones are things he plays now and again, still interested in. The third lot, as good as put them on eBay. Not that I will.
Thunder Phase.
Another one from Steph. If you had to LARP, would you do horror, swords and sorcery, skiffy, sci-fi?
I certainly wouldn't be using a flail in any one of those situations. I think this is a good question.
First of all, let's, you know, like other podcasts, challenge the premise of the question. Under what circumstances would we have to do a LARP?
Have to? Oh, we lost some weird bet. Lost a weird bet. Oh, we were offered a huge amount of money.
So what would you go for?
I think it raises an interesting question about dressing up, doesn't it? Because my temptation is to say horror, because I think I probably wouldn't have to dress up, would I?
That's your only criteria.
But isn't that a big part of it? Because I when you see some of these cosplayer type people dressed as a Viking and they've done a great job, they're wearing proper chainmail and a sword and everything. Sometimes I think, that's great, isn't it? Imagine being dressed as a Viking. That's kind of really good. It's great, that. Well done. But often with LARPing, sometimes the things you see, you think, wearing a bit of old carpet and hitting them with a rubber sword. Not quite sure that's for me. So dressing up is, you can't get away from the dressing up element of it, can you?
I don't know.
But with horror,
I don't think my nerves would be able to take it.
Yeah.
I think I'd find it too anxiety inducing to do horror. Yeah,
and I suppose it depends what is meant by horror, because I'm not very familiar with the idea of horror LARPing, what that entails. So maybe it would be fantasy, because although I'd have to dress up, at least I know what I'm letting myself in for. I have a better understanding of it, you know.
With science fiction, they do have these things where you replicate the bridge of Star Trek, don't they? So would you participate in something like that?
Well, that'd be quite good, wouldn't it? Yeah, that'd be quite interesting.
Yeah. I'm not sure as it would be, because I think we've both been involved in contingency exercises at work, haven't we? And to me, that is a bit like the bridge of the Star Trek Enterprise, isn't it?
I must admit, I was involved in one of those. It's a bit like the, what's it called, the Kobayashi Maru exercise, isn't it, in Star Trek, which is the Star Trek, the training exercise. You can't win. The training to defeat and how to deal with defeat. The one that Captain Kirk fiddles with and cheats on so that he can win. That's what my contingency exercise with the council felt like, you know. I felt like, is this a training exercise to train me in defeat?
Well, the other thing is like LARPing, isn't it? And this is why I would find it an inauthentic experience, because my experience of doing those, because you get these smart asses, don't you? Pick up the phone and say, yes, I've set up an emergency mortuary at such and such school. Oh, have you? Oh, very
no, you
good.
Have. No, you haven't. Just... No, you haven't. That happened to me on that continues. There were people doing that. Did that happen to you when you did?
Yeah.
People just picking up the phone and saying, oh, yeah, I've evacuated everybody and we've put them up in temporary accommodation. No, you've not. You've just said it. That's a lot of crap.
These things are easy to say. They're harder to do, aren't they?
They're harder to actually do. It's a real exercise. You can't just say it and then make it and it happens, you know. I cast fireball. No, you're not. Same principle. But I do think for me, dressing up would be a factor. It would be a factor. I think I would probably go for horror. Because chances are you just come turn up in your own clothes. I wouldn't have to dress up.
I'd go for a thing. I'd quite like to do Star Wars. I think, I'd buy into that cosplay, actually. And play an alien in the canteen.
No. You see, again, dressing up and me don't go hand in hand, because I'm huge, aren't I? I'm 6'5". Nothing fits. I turn up and they'd say, you look like a great Viking warrior, wouldn't you? Or a great this, that, or the other. Right, try this on. It's too small. It's too small. Everything's would be too small. I'd look like someone who's just drunk a potion of enlargement or something and clothes of them. You know, or Star Wars LARPing. They'd just say, oh, you look, the Wookiee's here. Put this on. For God's sake. That's the thing with dressing up. Me and Claire.
Let's get the Ewok costume for this guy. Come on, let's get him in it. Come on.
You make a great Ewok. He's too small. No. So yeah, I think horror, just on the grounds that I could wear my own clothes and I don't have to dress up.
Thunderface.
What is the best toolkit RPG? That's from Kevin T.
I'm tempted to say Savage Worlds. That's what pops into my head. Instantly, Savage Worlds. But then I don't know, maybe Traveller. Yeah, we've talked about that before, haven't we? That Traveller is a toolbox. although it has a setting and people tend not to use it as a toolbox, but it is a toolbox role-playing game, isn't it? Sci-fi role-playing game. You can do anything with Traveller, and it has rules to allow you to do anything. You don't have to do it in the setting. The two things run side by side, don't they?
It's a question close to my heart at the moment, because I've got the new BRP. You know, they've released it. The gold book has been re-released and set out differently. And I've started looking at a campaign in the campaign world that I did as PBM. And it has made me think a little differently. You know, the question we said about IPs before and, you know, whether we like those games that are set in game worlds and ready-made worlds. And I have been having this debate in my head over these last few months over this idea of, right, over the last few years, I've been running a lot of big book campaigns. Now is the time for me to create my own and do my own thing and create my own world using a toolkit system and do it from scratch, and that'll be a great experience. But by doing that, I've learned something about myself and where I find the fun in role-playing games. And I've realized that I don't necessarily find the fun in building things from scratch. I think it's good to have something to base it on. And when we've had this debate on the Discord about big book campaigns and homebrew stuff, you know, make it a home for cheaper and all that kind of thing, there are some people who say, I've no time to run the big book campaigns. And then there's others who say, I've no time to make it myself. Mm-hmm. So clearly, it depends upon where you find the fun in spending the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think as well, yeah, it's okay to say, I'm going to make a campaign and a world from scratch. But sometimes you would find, if you're going to do that properly, quite a big thing. It starts off as quite a small thing.
Yeah.
It starts off as something that seems quite manageable, but it can quickly kind of get ram. Long time when we were younger, that we both tried things like that. And ultimately they became slightly demoralizing, I think.
Yeah.
You know? And I wonder whether as well, because, you know, whether were they kind of instrumental in putting us off the hobby.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we bit off more than we could chew. And then we felt a bit demoralized to say, oh, we can't really do our own worlds. It's all a bit more, you know, I don't know. Maybe not.
I think it does come down to this thing is where do you find the fun? So there are people who spend lots of time building up foundry play areas, creating character sheets, creating map on Foundry and the world, and creating artifacts like handouts and that is, they derive a lot of pleasure from doing that. For me, I see that as a bit of a chore.
I'm somewhere in the middle, I think, with it. I like it to a point, but like you, I like to have something that I can work with. I quite enjoy having a setting or a scenario or maybe a campaign that I can use and utilize and change and make it my own. I find that quite a nice, comfortable place to be in, because you're being creative, you're using your own imagination and changing things and using ideas in your own way. But you're also, you've got some kind of safety net there, just in terms of, like you say, in terms of time and effort and work and life and family and all the other stuff that gets in the way, you've got something there as a framework that you can build it on, really. Like, I suppose like a model, it's like almost like a model kit, isn't it? It's the difference between I'm going to build a Spitfire from scratch out of wood, and the difference between that and going to a shop and buying a model of a Spitfire. And I'm somewhere in the middle where I like a model kit of a Spitfire. I'm building it, doing my own thing with it. But it is a.
I think they call that kit bashing, don't they? Taking a. Taking some old bits of a model kit and making it your own and transforming it
quite,
into.
I get a lot of fun out of that kind of thing. I like looking at a scenario and going, this is good, but you know what? Get rid of that, change that, do this. And yeah. I get quite a lot of fun out of that.
Rightly or wrongly, I use this equation. And this equation I use is that if I've got a 2-hour session, then the preparation should really take no longer than 2 hours.
Yeah.
Is that a bit much or?
But, I think it's very optimistic.
But outside
you're of a born that, opti- you are a born optimist though.
But outside of that, what I don't include in the labour of that 2 hours is reading stuff and thinking about stuff. So
it's the practical side of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So in that 2 hours, if it's a 2-hour session, I want to be spending a lot less actually in creating stuff that makes that happen. I've done all the thinking, I've done the reading and I've written some notes, but I don't want to be doing the chore of all that stuff. And if that takes longer than the session, then I feel like my expectation would be too high on the session and it would never deliver.
On that basis, going back to the question, would you say you're not really a fan of the toolkit role-playing game? Because it inevitably involves more work. So Savage Worlds, if you said, right, I'm going to run this in Savage Worlds and take a movie setting or something like that, does it take considerable amount more time? Because Savage Worlds is a great toolkit, but you have to do quite a bit of work to make that game work for that particular setting or that particular idea, as opposed to, and I suppose this goes back to the earlier question from Bill Van Mike about IP, isn't it? As opposed to saying, well, I'm just going to get the game that replicates that. So we were going back to Alien, for example. Is it better to you know what? I'm just going to buy the Alien game, then I can run Alien type game, a few Alien type games using the Alien game because it's ready built. Or should I use Savage Worlds? But is it the case that if you choose, and I'm not picking on Savage Worlds in particular, but if you decided to use Savage Worlds, it would take considerably more time to prepare your game because you've got to take that toolkit game and shape it so that it fits the world you want it to world. So like Savage Worlds, you'd have to think about the characters' edges and the hindrances and the monsters and how they would work and what kind of weapons people would have and pick this and pick that and think about the spaceships and think, all right, well, which spaceships from these toolkits am I going to use? And that, so it's a lot more work, isn't it, than just buying the IP game and going, well, I'll buy that and I'll run it in that, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And I've done a bit of that. So I took Strontium Dog and created it into Savage Worlds. So the way I did it was to take the Mongoose Strontium Dog game and to take the Wine Strontium Dog game and actually just remodel Savage Worlds using elements of that. So it reduced some of the effort because there was some of the stuff in there. So some of the guns were listed there. So it was like an adaptation of that. In answer to your question, I'm probably halfway between. Like you said, I'm probably a kit user, but I want to knock it into my own shape rather than a scratch builder. With the Reckless campaign, so this thing I did for my PBM, you know, it's bringing back a lot of memories of playing it back in the 80s and some of the stuff I did back then. And there is a bit of a delight in just writing down things and doing it. But realizing that these have got like different monsters in there. And some people would find that completely exciting, wouldn't they, to create new monsters from scratch and what the features are and what they're. And that is great. That is great. But it's a lot of effort to create a stat block of it, an effort that I don't particularly enjoy. I think my instinct is to look at, right, let's have a look at the RuneQuest rulebook and can I reskin one of these monsters to bypass the fact that I've got to build this from scratch?
And I suppose that's what I was kind of talking about earlier, about biting off more than you can chew, because if you're creating a world, it's all right to think of one unique monster. So one unique monster in a scenario might be fun. So if you were running a campaign in Glorantha and you thought, you know what, I'm going to invent a new monster for Glorantha, that would be quite an appealing idea. But if you were doing a whole world where you thought every monster's got to be unique, every monster's got to be, I'm not going to have monsters that are stolen from other settings. All my monsters are going to be unique. That's quite a challenge, isn't it, to do that?
That is a challenge, and that's a challenge that I did in 1987. It broke me, and I stopped role-playing for 20 odd years.
Yeah, there you go. I think that's the thing, isn't it? It can start off as like, oh, yeah, I'll invent a world. How hard can it be? And before you know it, that desire to go, oh, well, hang on, I'm creating a world, but I don't want dwarves living in the mountains, because every world's got dwarves living in the mountains. I'm going to do something different. And that thing, oh, blimey, what do I do that's different? How do I do it differently? And that's an incredible amount of creative energy to do that. It's a hell of a commitment, really, when it starts to kind of unfold. But going back to the question, that's not the question.
We have another question.
The question, what's the best, if you're going to do it, what's the best toolkit? I would say Savage Worlds. I'd say Savage Worlds, because I think you can do anything with it quite relatively easily, I think.
Yeah, I agree with you. Savage Worlds is good for a certain type of play, I think. If you want a pulp play, it works really well. And I suppose I was tempted with the campaign that I'm planning with in the PBM world to do it in Savage Worlds. However, I wanted it to be a little bit more gritty. And I think that's why I've gone for basic role-playing. And because I had great fun last year playing Stormbringer, and I know it and I can intuitively think about how it might work. But I'd say basic role-playing, and the book's really nice, this new book.
There you go. Savage Worlds or basic role-playing.
Yeah.
Thunder Phase.
Let's have another one. Has your playstyle changed over the years after playing so many different games? And that's from Ian Engelback.
Good question.
I can answer this question for you and say your playstyle has changed.
Right, okay. In what sense? Go on. This is the best way to do it, because I was just about to say it's very difficult to be self-aware, isn't it?
When I say playstyle, I think I'll rephrase that. Your games mastering style has changed significantly from the person you were. I think even, I've said this in previous podcasts, even like a few years ago, you've become more, I don't want to use it adaptable, but you're more willing to take risks with where the players want to take things, and less restricted, letting things go into places and being willing to make things up on the hoof and play with it a bit. And one of the things that you've started to say that I don't think you used to say is things are, oh, I like that and I'm going to support it. I'm going to help you make this work. And I think that's how you've changed as a GM. I don't think you've changed much as a player. I think as a player, you're still bloody cautious about everything.
Cautious wizard, yeah. No, I think you're right, actually. And I think the reason I've changed over the last sort of 10 years is because now playing with people that you trust, it's a trust thing, isn't it? So as a games master, my early experience has been a games master running Traveller with Simon, being obstructive when we were kids, put me in a position of not wanting to let players do things, not wanting to run because it was just kind of obstructive and disruptive, wasn't it?
And similar with our experiences years later with Kevin for that short period, that was all very hostile, wasn't it? And
And we had other experiences like that as well. When we went to Tom's for a while, that was a bit like that. Well, you know, I mean, you had your experience of Golden Heroes, didn't you? You know, the terrible experience with Golden Heroes that's been sort of recounted, hasn't it? Where, you know, it was just silently putting things back in the box because they were quite hostile towards it, weren't they? That kind of experience. Whereas now, it's a much far more different experience, isn't it? Where the people we play with, who games master for us and we games master for them, people look more, probably because we're all older. I mean, not necessarily, I suppose, because Tom, when we went to Tom's, they were quite a bit older, weren't they, those?
Yeah. But is that down to the people that we play with? Has that changed significantly? Or is it the games that we play? Because a big factor of how we used to play was death, wasn't it? Death was going to be, play a character, death was around the corner.
Yeah.
Every session. Whereas it's much more unlikely. I can't really think of one. A few convention one-shots where characters have died at the table. But it doesn't really happen in
longer
play sessions.
Yeah, less perhaps adversarial. Yeah. So I think you're right. I think I have changed in that sense. Have you changed? Have you changed?
I have changed.
I'm still doing it by the seat of your pants.
I'm still doing it by the seat of my pants, yeah.
I think you've changed in the opposite way. Not that you're not open to player ideas, but I remember when we were younger, you would go off on a complete flight of fancy. You would just do whatever came into your head. And it was great. It was great because I remember really enjoying it. But you would tie yourself in knots sometimes.
Yeah.
Whereas I think now you're actually more controlled and restrained as a GM. Not restrained, but you're more, you're not daft enough to go off on a complete flight of fancy with something. Whereas when we were kids, that's what you would do. We were kind of opposites in a way. I was kind of quite controlling. I didn't want players to do things that I didn't want them to do because I didn't trust them because they were going to completely upend my game. And you, on the other hand, I suppose you had a different experience with Simon because he loved RuneQuest.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You could play to the gallery a bit, couldn't you?
Yeah.
And we'd go along with it and that kind of thing. Whereas I think now you're more of a thoughtful games master. So you'll look at things and think it through more. Whereas when we were kids, when we were younger, you would just go off.
Go with it.
And then they're thinking, where's he going with it? It's great, but does he really know where he's going with it? Whereas I think now you do know where you're going with it.
Yeah. I think as a player, what I've noticed as a player, I think this has been affected by playing a lot online. And as a face-to-face player, I used to be quite a generous player. But I do think that you get bad habits with virtual tabletops. And I'm noticing other people as well. I'm very conscious of it myself that you do tend to play your own game. And we've mentioned that before, haven't we? I think that with Pirates of Drinix, it's a really great crew that we've got. But sometimes they look at me and thinking, where the hell are you going with this? And I always share my plans with the other players. But they still think, oh my God, where are you going with this? What is this? I think we played last night, didn't we? We were playing Rippers last night and I was trying to negotiate with the baddies and
trying to wind them up after they'd surrendered.
I think that's
how we've changed. Like you say, I'm a bit more open and you're a little bit more controlled. And I don't mean by controlled, I mean controlling.
I think what Ian's pointing at actually is the examples he gives is, because I know that for Ian, he makes a great distinction between role playing and role playing. R-O-L-L versus R-O-L-E playing. Do we feel ourselves more a game or is it like the land of make believe? And I think it's fair to say that we've always straddled the middle of it, haven't we?
Yeah,
to varying degrees. So.
I think so. And I mean, as has been discussed before, the amateur dramatics side of it, I find a bit tedious. I find that role, R-O-double, it is about role playing, as in you playing a character and that character should act in a particular way and should have a personality and do things that you wouldn't necessarily do. But I find some of the amidrami stuff I find it a bit much. So I suppose I think you're right. We kind of straddle the two. but I suppose I err on the side of the gamer rather than the amateur thespian.
But I think that's always been the case. I don't think.
But
we've always varied between reported third, speaking in third party as a character.
I think though, where we have, I think that's something you hit on earlier in this section, where we've changed is, I think both of us are a bit more, or certainly me, I can't speak for you, but certainly me, I'm a bit more open to the idea of playing a character. As you say, I'm a cautious player, but I'm more open to the idea of a character playing, doing things I wouldn't normally do, because the games we play now feel less adversarial.
Yeah.
So it feels like 30 years ago, if you said, oh, my character is a very curious character, so he's going to open the door, you're going to die.
Yeah.
So don't do that. Don't play a curious character. Don't play a character who's a loudmouth who winds the baddies up. Don't play a character who's brave. Just be completely tactical. Check for trap. You know, get a henchman to open the door, that kind of thing. Whereas now, we're far more, because I've played in games where there's a lot of trust, and like you say, you don't feel like the games master's trying to kill you at every opportunity. You're more inclined to play a role and feel that, you know, you can put your character out on a limb a little bit in the knowledge that it's not necessarily going to result in immediate death because you've been tactically stupid. So when we played with Kevin, though, there were times where, you know, there was a lot of pressure to say, no, check for traps. No, do this, do that. Tactical, survival kind of role playing. And there's some fun in that. There is some fun in that. But sometimes it inhibits you playing an actual character, doesn't it?
Because
character has flaws that put you in jeopardy. You know, and now you feel now, I think now the word play now is, I feel as a player, I could put my character in jeopardy, with the understanding that that doesn't necessarily mean certain death. Whereas in about 1983, it did.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Thunderface!
Okay, this is going to be the last question.
Okay.
Now that Judge Blythe has got the DCC bug bad, when will he be swapping his rules lawyer gavel for a death stamp?
I have looked at ordering a death stamp. I do need to get one.
That's from Jules Haley, of course.
I know it is, yeah. I've looked at getting a death stamp because they're quite good.
you have got it bad, haven't you? You have got, it's the latest thing. I mean, and you've moved into MCC as well, haven't you?
I do think it's, I just think it's a really, really clever game that encapsulates lots of old school stuff that's fun, but also lots of new school stuff that's fun as well. It does a really good job of, and also what I like about it is it's fun, because sometimes with these games, you can lose the fun, can't you?
Yeah.
You can find yourself in a situation where it's ever so serious. And the thing with DCC is, I wouldn't say it's not a comedy game, but it has qualities that mean it's just fun. The rules and the way the rules work and the way the mechanics work, things happen, don't they? So I've run some DCC adventures that can be relatively straightforward and relatively simple. And in the hands of another game system, might be a bit boring, but DCC always livens it up. There'll always be some critical and fumble rolls. There'll always be some mishaps with the spells. There'll always be some wacky stuff that kind of happens that keeps it kind of buoyant and interesting and fun.
Yeah.
You know, whenever I play it, people seem to enjoy themselves. And that, there's a lot to be said for it, because people talk about games a lot. And I suppose you go back to Key Harbor, people talking about it on social media. And you're not allowed to drop the fun bomb, but sometimes they should be fun, shouldn't they?
Yeah.
They should actually be, you know, the old beer and pretzels thing. You know, they should be enjoying yourself with these things.
Yeah, you see, you know, we have done a great thing of looping back to the beginning, because I suppose at the heart of Stu Hovarth's premise that the RPG hobby is resistant to theory is this idea that we've mentioned it before, the fun torpedo. Any argument can be diffused by firing the fun torpedo, and it's defining what that fun is. And people have fun in different ways, but there's no really way of defining that, because it's personal to you, isn't it? And you know it when you see it.
You do. And I do. I think DCC, I think it does. It has fun like baked into the system. It's baked in, so that it's inevitable. And also, what's good about it is it is designed around practical kind of play, if you know what I mean. So all the modules they do are things that you can buy relatively. And we're going back to like the big book campaign thing. You know, you look at some publishers, some role playing game publishers, they publish scenarios that all seem quite a commitment. So you look at certain games companies, and they don't produce that many scenarios. And what they do produce are kind of lavish 3-part campaigns, or, you know, things that involve a bit of commitment. And what Goodman Games do is they produce modules that you can go, this will take a couple of sessions and it'll be fun, you know. And that's what you need. And that's why I do think it's a great game, you know. And I can see why people do become obsessed with it. Yeah. And going back to the character death as well, I suppose it connects to that, doesn't it, with the funnels, that you can kill characters without, you know, you can go back to that idea of killing characters, but without causing too much offence. Yeah. Everyone knows the score, don't they, when you're doing a funnel.
Well, I think it's time to hit the death stamp on this Thunder Phase. Okay. So thank you to all the listeners who've sent in questions. There's another pile of them here. We've not gone through them.
Same for the next one.
Do you know, I think we need to call it something different. If we did it a bit faster, what's faster than thunder?
Lightning?
Nah, we're not going to have lightning rains.
That won't catch up. That's a stupid idea. Yeah.
See you, Blythe.
See ya.
Postbag!
The sack has been especially full for our discussion of White Dwarf covers, introduced by our friend at Daily Dwarf in the first part of this episode. It seems that nothing is more likely to trigger a warm sense of nostalgia than White Dwarf covers. Everyone has their favourite from the first 106 issues. Steph said, "Number 54 was and still is my favourite. It's so evocative and laden with potential. That sword emanates power and was just awesome. It's also the first White Dwarf I purchased with my pocket money. I managed to get this cover on the White Dwarf t-shirts that were done a few years ago and only wear it for very special occasions. When will more of those t-shirts be produced? I'd love to get a few more." Yeah, there was a brief period on the Games Workshop online store that had covers available on t-shirts, but they're not there anymore. I keep watching out for them. Bill P on Discord said, "Hi everyone, really enjoyed the episode on White Dwarf covers. I was very interested in how people's favourites are linked to their early encounters with the games. Would like to put a shout out for issue 1. It seemed so new and a great leap forward of the hobby. Our school had a war games group, and although Coastal, a World War II miniature ships game, and Avalon Hill and SBI had been on the go, by 1975 we were playing RPGs at lunchtimes in the art rooms. The group had a great leader who had a photographic memory for rules. His mum had access to a photocopy machine, and AD&D first appeared to me like that. They were great campaigns in those early days, and our younger kids got in making campaigns of their own. To get back to White Dwarf 1, I want to say that we were ready for it. Before that, fanzines on the subject had been A5, often brilliant, but had like a university ragmag feel. Love the art, love the title, and who came up with all that? So, Thank you anyway, guys, for a massive trip down memory lane. Jem Gilbert, also on Discord, added, listened whilst peeling Sunday spuds. Lovely stuff. I was getting positively misty-eyed over Irelion and the necromancer at his desk. It was the soft porn covers that upset my parents and which did embarrass me in front of them and my little sisters. When 72 came out, with its depiction of a fully clothed woman defending the male characters with her gun, it felt like a victory for progress. To be honest, I remember my heart sank when that 75 cover came out with its spray-on cocktail dress and completely anachronistically for the 1920s fashion, unnecessarily exposed cleavage. That 72 cover is far from being the most memorable image artistically. For me, that has to be the necromancer's study. But it's always stuck in my mind as representing a short-lived attempt to make White Dwarf more progressive. It also made me think how great it would be to play in a Call of Cthulhu game in which a cool flapper girl with a gun might defend a couple of nerdy blokes. Here's some editorial insight from Mark Gascoigne, no less, who was on the team at White Dwarf. When I joined Games Workshop in spring 1984, my prime job was to expand Rick Priestley's core game system into a fully realised Judge Dredd role-playing game. However, it was obvious I was a much-needed extra pair of hands that could be turned to a variety of other jobs. One day, Ian Livingstone swung by the White Dwarf office where I was camped in the corner next to my fellow Dragon Lords alumni, Ian Marsh, and asked if I fancied a road trip. In no time, we were strapped into his new red Porsche, headed for Islington, and dropped off at the offices of Young Artists, the notable illustration agency. Under the expert guidance of Val, sorry, I forget her surname, but she became Val Edwards when she married the artist Les Edwards. I then spent a happy hour or so leafing through swathes of transparencies of awesome fantasy art, with the express need of licensing them for the use as White Dwarf covers. Some had been used on the Dwarf already, of course, and others were just too well known, usually as famous science fiction novel covers, too strongly associated with their original use. Many of the others were unsuitable because of layout, subject matter, or the sheer amount of naked flesh, but soon enough I gathered 30 or so potential pieces. These were carefully boxed up and taken back to the Games Workshop headquarters in North Acton for White Dwarf designer Mary Common to review so she could make the final selection. Across the next couple of years, we would gather to firm up the likely contents of each issue and agree on a suitable cover. A big traveller article called for a dynamic spaceship picture, something more cadaverous for an undead in D&D article, etc. Sometimes nothing we had access to really suited, so we just picked from what we had, with mixed results. We never had much in the Cthulhu mould, but around the same time, a suitably eldritch submission out of the blue came from the talented and cheap newcomer called Lee Gibbons, and he sorted that. Variety was important, and even if the covers didn't always match the content exactly, the overall intention was to summon up the feeling of the fantastical possibility that RPGs brought. So there we go. Thanks everyone who contributed to the discussion. If you'd like an invite to the Discord channel, then contact me at dirkthedice@gmail.com.
The Save Rap podcast covers old school gaming and the modern games inspired by them. Listen in to hear about games from the 70s and 80s, as well as their modern descendants. You can download episodes wherever podcasts are found, on iTunes, Google, and other fine podcast distributors. You should also check them out on saferhalf.com or email them at saferhalfpodcast@gmail.com.
Well, I did say that it was a rambling one. I think the virtuous had kicked in by that point. Thanks to everyone who continues to support us by putting in a few coins in the beret. Patrons past and present and the forthcoming have all helped to encourage us to continue doing this thing. And it's funded additional projects and paid for the various hosting and subscription costs. We're very grateful. We have some new patrons join us recently. They've become honorary members of the Armchair Adventurers Club. And they are Mohammed Sadiq, Steen Strupian, Tor Nielsen. They can put their feet up on a fancy poof. Rod Osborne is on the So Far So Good level, and I'd like to give them a virtual gift from a table rolled apparently at random. This time it's from White Dwarf Covers to Cherish. So I'll roll a D100. 26. A cover which is Daily Dwarf's favourite, the Ian McCaig's Dragon's Wrath. If we've missed anyone with these dedications, then please let me know. Also, if in the past we've mangled up your name and it's come out incorrectly, let me know and we'll have another go at it. Thanks for listening. Please pass on the Grognard Files if you enjoy listening. Also, it's good to get reviews. So if you do get the chance, please put some words on your podcast app of choice explaining why you listen to us. And 5 stars are good too. It will allow the great algorithm to work it all out. Right, I'm just going to put this cassette in here and hope that it loads. Yeah, it's okay. I'm getting the yellow and purple lines. We should be good to go. Oh, no. Until next time, adios, amigos.